My confession for this week is, I have never fertilized anything. Not with anything you'd call fertilizer. It turns out that's not necessarily a big deal. If you don't have any issues, you don't need to fertilize things growing in the ground. What's growing in pots in your home and on your patio, that's a different story. I'm Shauna Doby, the editor of Canada's Local Gardener magazine, and this is Flora and Fauna. This week I spoke with Robert Pavlis, who is a writer and researcher on things to do with the garden. He has written two volumes called Garden Myths, a book called Building Natural Ponds, another called Soil Science for Gardeners, and another called Compost Science for Gardeners. He writes a couple of websites, gardenfundamentals.com and gardenmyths.com. He has a YouTube channel and he has a Facebook group. Oh, and he keeps a 6-acre botanical garden near Guelph, Ontario, called Aspen Grove. In short, he is a wonder. We talked about fertilizer in the garden. Tell me a little bit more about your background. I know you have a science background, and what does that entail?
So I have a bachelor's in chemistry and a master's in biochemistry. And then I went into business and sales, selling laboratory equipment. Did that for 9 years. And then I started my own software company, selling laboratory software, and did that for 25 years. And I retired.
Fabulous.
There's no plants in there. So it was always just a hobby for me, but I'm one of those people that tend to get serious about hobbies. About 19 years ago, I started to semi-retire and we bought a 6-acre property, which is our Aspen Grove Gardens. And I turned it into a botanical garden where we grow about 3,000 different plants. And that's around that time, too, is when I started doing most of this writing. And so it was a combination of learning about the plants and growing them. And I'd always grown plants. I've always had gardens, but this was a larger garden than normal. And it also took me down a road where I ended up doing a lot more learning than I had in the past. But I approach everything from a scientific point of view because of my science background.
Tell me a little bit more about Aspen Grove. Is it open to the public?
No, it's a private garden. And I do have open houses from time to time. And I open it up with various charities and so on. Last year, I actually had it open the first Saturday of every month because people want to see the garden rest through the seasons. And so it was open quite a bit last year. This year, we probably only be open a couple times. I do have a lot of horticulture groups come in. So I'll open up for a group like that.
Aspen Grove is located in Southern Ontario.
Yep.
And I used to be located in Southern Ontario, but I've just moved to Winnipeg about 6 months ago and am sorely regretting the fact that I never did go to Aspen Grove.
Yeah. So we're south end of Guelph. So zone mm-hmm. 5.
Okay. So we're going to talk about essentially feeding your soil. Tell me what you mean by feeding the soil instead of the plants.
Let's start with feeding the soil. I actually don't like that term either. I think it gives people the wrong impression that somehow we have to keep putting this food, which we call fertilizer, into the soil. And that's not what we do. We don't actually have to feed soil. We also don't feed plants, which is an even more common concept, right? People are constantly asking online, oh, what do I feed my plants? How often should I feed my plants? The bottom line is we don't feed plants. And I think if gardeners would learn to understand that, it will change the way they fertilize. It'll change what they use for fertilizing, and they'll help them understand how plants grow much better. And the reason why both those terms are incorrect is, for example, my garden. So I grow 3,000 things. I don't fertilize anything. Okay. And the reason I don't is because when we fertilize, our job is to replace the nutrients that are missing in the soil. If nothing is missing, we don't have to fertilize. So we don't take this special concoction and feed the soil. what we do is we look at the soil and find out what's missing and only replace those items that are missing. And that's quite different than a feeding program. Immediately, people think this is something I have to do on a regular basis. I have to figure out what this best food is, and then I keep giving it to my soil. And that's not what we're really doing with gardens. Now, there are some exceptions to that. So when I say gardens, I'm talking about soil outside and an ornamental type bed. I'm not talking about containers, either outside or houseplants, because those generally don't have soil in them.
In your planters, you often have what's called a soilless mix. Soilless mix is typically made mostly of peat moss or core to hold on to water. It also contains bark to create space in the water, perlite to enhance drainage and air and to increase water retention, and vermiculite, which also holds on to water. You don't put soil in pots because it's too heavy. Soilless mixes also typically contain a wetting agent because peat is really hard to get wet. What soilless mix doesn't contain, until it's added, is nutrients. When you buy a potted plant at the store, it usually has a slow-release fertilizer added to it, but these get washed away as you water the plant, and eventually you're going to have to add more fertilizer or watch your plant slowly die.
We're talking about real soil. For many people, there's really no reason to fertilize their gardens. The other exception might be vegetable gardens, particularly in a short season like Winnipeg or Ontario, where our goal there is to grow food rapidly because we have such a short season. And so we might fertilize there, we might add nutrients to speed up that process and get a maximum yield out of our vegetables. But as far as all our ornamental stuff goes, they're usually just fine. You only have to add nutrients to the soil when we know there's a deficiency. Right. And that's the big difference. Another way I try to present this to people is I look at plant-specific fertilizers. So you can go to the store, you can buy rose fertilizer and tomato fertilizer and African violet fertilizer and orchid fertilizer and so on. And what I do in talks is I get pictures from the internet of all these rose fertilizers and I present them all. And if we look at them, they all have a different NPK formula. How can they all be rose fertilizer if they're all different? The simple answer is that none of them are rose fertilizer. There really is no such thing as a rose fertilizer or a tomato fertilizer. And the other way to look at this is, what if you have two gardeners and they both want to grow roses and one has a nitrogen deficiency and the other one has a phosphate deficiency? Would those two gardeners use the same fertilizer? And the answer is no. One has to add nitrogen and one has to add phosphate. And those nutrients that are there in large enough quantities, you don't have to add. You only have to add the deficiencies. So what we're doing is replacing the nutrients in soil. We're not feeding plants.
Right. So if you put nutrients into the soil, does it really matter what ratio they're in? Because eventually, if you add enough, then the phosphorus is going to be there or the potassium is going to be there. There might be a lot more of something else.
Yeah. The ratio is important for understanding how much plants use. And a very common ratio is a 3-1-2 ratio. So they need about three times as much nitrogen as phosphate, and the potassium is somewhere in between that. And if you use fertilizer in a 3-1-2 ratio, that will provide the nutrients for pretty much all types of plants in pretty much the right ratios. But when we're adding it to soil, then we only add the nutrients that are missing. So the ratio doesn't matter. We don't care about the ratio. Now, at some point, you have to decide how much do we need in soil, and then the ratio is important. But when we're actually applying the material, we just apply what's needed. So we don't go by the ratio. Now, in container plants, that's different. Containers and house plants. because there we're using a soilless mix and we pretty much can assume there's no nutrients in there, partly because we water all the time and partly because the material that's in there isn't providing natural nutrients. And so there we fertilize on a regular basis with a 3-1-2, because in containers like that with a soilless mix, we're adding 100% of the nutrients plants need. And in fact, it's important to also add the micronutrients there because those aren't there either. But soil supplies a lot of those things. So in soil, you can pretty much ignore the micronutrients in most cases. And all we're really supplying is some of the macronutrients. And the one that's usually missing is the nitrogen. So most soil in North America has lots of phosphate. That's not something we normally have to add. We may need to add some potassium, and we almost always have to add nitrogen. Because nitrogen is that nutrient that is keeping plants from growing bigger, right? It's the thing that's holding them back from growing.
Do you want to hear a couple of jokes? What do you call a self-employed individual who works with fertilizer? An entrepreneur. What did the composting wrapper say? Break it down now, y'all. And I always pour leftover chicken soup into my composter because chicken soup is good for the soil. I've heard you, or I've read you say before, that nitrogen fixing plants don't really help the soil. Is that? Tell me about that.
Yeah, gardeners have this impression that if I grow a nitrogen fixing plant like the legume, that it fixes the nitrogen, and then this nitrogen somehow seeps into the soil as the plant's growing and provides nitrogen for other plants. So they will suggest, well, grow a tomato plant and put some peas beside it. The peas are fixing the nitrogen, and that nitrogen is going over to tomato plant and helping the tomato plant grow. And that's not what happens. So this legume likes its nitrogen. It doesn't let a lot of it go into the soil. So as the plant's growing, it keeps the nitrogen. Another good example is putting clover into your lawn. People think that clover is feeding the lawn because the clover is a legume. It's making nitrogen, and that nitrogen is feeding the lawn. And that's not really what happens. The legume keeps the nitrogen for itself, because nitrogen is really precious to plants, and so they hog it, and it keeps it. Where the nitrogen goes is most of it goes into the fruit of the plant. So when we pick the peas, say, off a pea plant, we're actually removing most of the fixed nitrogen. And then whatever is left, there's a little bit left, and we dig that in, then it adds nitrogen. If I mow my lawn and I cut off the clover leaves and I leave those leaves on the lawn to decompose, then I'm also adding nitrogen to the grass.
Right? Nitrogen is in a form that the plants can take up?
No, not yet. And that's another really big misunderstanding that gardeners have. If I take a leaf from a clover plant, or any organic fertilizer. So this could be a banana peel, it could be some manure, it could be some compost, anything that's organic. And I put it beside a plant, it's useless for the plant, right? All those nutrients are tied up in large molecules. So it doesn't feed the plant. Now, slowly that organic matter decomposes. And over several years, it slowly releases the nutrients, and then it feeds the plant. But that's a slow process. And this, I think, is a big mistake that people make, is they want to go organic. So what they do is they find themselves an organic fertilizer, right? Outside it might be different types of meals, which are just ground up plant material, or it could be compost or manure. Inside, people use things like fish emulsion or kelp, and then they put it on their plants. Say, I just fertilized my plants. I've just given them some nutrients. But in fact, they haven't. Okay. The nutrients are there, but they're tied up in these large molecules. So the plant can't use them. We now have to wait until these decompose. So one of the myths I get a real kick out of is when people plant tomatoes, for instance, they put a banana peel in the hole and they say, I just fed my tomato plant. No, you haven't, because that banana peel will take 3 to 5 years to decompose and release the nutrients. Now, if that plant is there for 5 years, then it gets some benefits. But our tomatoes are only there for a few months in a short season. And so it doesn't feed the plant at all. Now, it may feed next year's tomato and the tomato you plant the year after, but it doesn't feed this year's tomato.
Okay. I'm not a proponent of burying a banana peel with your tomato, but if it is decomposing that whole time, the potassium would be going into the soil throughout that, the three-year process, or would it wait till the end of it and that's when it's all released?
No, it's a continuous process.
So it would help.
It does help, but you have to remember a banana peel doesn't have a lot of nutrients in it to start with. And now we take that amount and spread it over 5 years. So for any given week, there's almost no fertilizer there. That's the problem. If we're trying to grow plants more quickly, and that's a lot of times what we want with our vegetable garden or with container plants, they need a certain amount of nitrogen continually available to them, right? And the organic material we're adding isn't going to supply that. In fact, most organic type of fertilizers have very low nitrogen levels, right? They're down in a sort of 1% range. And so that 1% is released over 5 years. So if we just use simple math, that every year you're only going to get 1/5 of that 1%. Well, 1% is already too low for this year. And now you're only going to give it 1/5 of that 1%. So you're basically starving your plants, right? You're giving it such low levels of nutrients that you're starving your plants.
It took me a while to understand nitrogen and soil and fixation and all of that. Here's what I understand. Nitrogen in the air is 2 bonded atoms of nitrogen, which is inert. It enters the ground in rain and snow where the atoms bond with oxygen, which plants can take up. It also enters the ground in dead plants and animal feces. Microbes in the soil convert the nitrogen in dead plants and animal feces into plant usable nitrogen. That's 2 ways that the nitrogen can get into the ground. The third way plant usable nitrogen enters the ground is through synthetic fertilizer, which is made by using high heat and pressure to form ammonium nitrate, which can be used by plants. But wait, the microbes in the soil that convert the nitrogen don't do it to be swell guys, they do it for energy. If they aren't getting enough energy from dead plants and animals, they will suck it right out of the soil. This can be good if there's more nitrogen than needed in the soil, but bad if there's less. The microbes turn the nitrogen back into inert gas, which goes back into the air. So why do the microbes sometimes make nitrogen usable and sometimes make it unusable? I don't know. Nonetheless, this nitrogen cycle is going on all the time and explains why the amount of usable nitrogen in soil is so hard to pin down. But that's only if that's the only place they're getting the nutrients from. Are you talking about a houseplant or a potted plant?
Yeah, it applies to everything in the garden. So in a potted plant, it's more important because that potted plant needs you to supply all the nutrients. In a garden, it may be getting its nutrients from the soil, so you don't have to supply as much. But if you have a deficiency of some kind, let's say your soil is deficient in potassium, then to make those plants grow, we have to add a fair amount of potassium right away to make them grow. Or we add a very small amount over time and let them grow really slowly. That's your choice. And so in a vegetable garden, you want them to grow quickly. You can't wait 5 years for your tomatoes. In an ornamental bed, there's no rush. Okay. In fact, to be quite honest, most things you don't want to grow too fast, right? Because they get too big. So in an ornamental bed, you don't have to fertilize a lot of times. You may be starving your plants a little bit, but they're getting some nutrients from the soil. And that's enough to keep them growing and looking good and flowering. then we don't have to add more. We don't have to make those plants grow faster. So it does depend on what your goal is. So if I'm out in the garden in an ornamental bed, that's why I don't fertilize. Now, a little bit of compost, an inch of compost on the soil, it would be good. It adds a little bit of extra. I mulch with wood chips, so that adds a little bit of nutrients. But I don't fertilize because I don't really want those plants growing very fast. In a container, though, we have to supply it all. And doing a container with organic fertilizers just doesn't work because you're not giving it enough nutrients. You're much better off with synthetic fertilizer. And that's actually one of the other big myths that people have is the difference between organic and synthetic fertilizers. And I know there's a great desire for people to go organic. And organic fertilizers are actually better in some ways. But synthetic is better in other ways. And so it's, first, if we look at this, the one thing that a lot of people don't understand is that when I take my banana, which is organic, and I put it in the soil, and it goes through this decomposition process, when it's finished decomposing, it produces nitrate molecules. That's the key thing that the plants need. Synthetic fertilizer gives me the exact same nitrate molecules. Okay. By the time the plant can use the nutrients, there is absolutely no difference between an organic source and a synthetic source. Okay. Chemically, they're identical. Same for the phosphate and same for the potassium and all the other nutrients, they're identical. And yet people have this strange idea that the organic is so much better and that synthetic harms the soil and harms the plants and degrades our soil and so on. And that just isn't true because in the end, they're both the same. Chemically, they're identical.
I'm a little bit nervous about the answer because my head starts to spin when we talk about chemistry. What is in a synthetic fertilizer? Nitrogen is nitrogen, or I guess there are different forms of it, but you can't make it. It's there, right? You have to collect it from somewhere.
If we look at nitrogen as an example, we actually do make the nitrogen that's in fertilizer. The air we're breathing right now is 80% nitrogen, but we can't use that. Plants can't use that. The only thing that is able to use it is a very specific types of microbes. So none of the other organisms can take that nitrogen from the air and use it. So when we make fertilizer, what we do is we actually take that nitrogen from the air and we use a chemical process to turn it into nitrate or urea usually. Okay. So those are simple chemical compounds. So we've taken the nitrogen from the air, created nitrate molecules.
Okay.
When we use an organic source, what happens is it starts out as a banana. And I use a banana as an example, but it could be anything, manure, plant leaves, doesn't matter what it is, something organic, right? It starts out looking like a plant, and then it slowly breaks apart and releases protein molecules, which are huge molecules. And they get degraded into amino acids, and they're still pretty big. And then the amino acids get broken down, and they release nitrate. And all of that's done by the microbes in the soil. The plants can only use that material once it's a nitrate molecule. So at that point, those molecules are the same, whether we made it or whether a plant made it, they're both nitrate molecules.
This is for my peeps out there who didn't get past grade 10 science like me. A nitrate molecule is the same whether it comes from a lab or a rainstorm or the ground. You can't tell the difference, and neither can your plants. The difference between a synthetic fertilizer and an organic one is the number of nitrate molecules in it. And if you need a lot of nitrate, or whatever, now, this summer, you can't pile on enough compost to give it to your vegetable plants. It would smother the plants. At least I think that's it. Let's take a break and hear from Ian at head office.
Canada's local gardener just got even better. Flora and Fauna, a new e-digest coming weekly, Go to localgardener.net to find out more information. That's localgardener.net.
We're back, and I'm talking to Robert Pavlis about nutrients in the garden. We talked a bit about NPK, nitrogen, phosphate, and potassium. I asked about sulfur.
Sulfur is exactly the same. All the other nutrients are the same. So the reason we talk about NPK is that those are the nutrients that are most likely missing in soil. Sulfur historically has never been low in soil. You might remember back a number of years ago, we used to have a real problem with acid rain. And that acid rain had a lot of sulfur in it, and it was pulling the sulfur out of the pollution we were putting into the air, and the rain would collect it and put it back into the soil, and that had a lot of sulfur in it. So we never had sulfur deficiencies in our farms. The other thing that happened was that fertilizer was made fairly impure, and it had sulfur in it. So we never had to worry about sulfur. We've cleaned up our act on the acid rain, and our fertilizers are purer and purer all the time. They have less and less sulfur. So we're going to get to a point where we actually will have sulfur deficiencies in North America. And it's interesting that some fertilizer in Australia, for instance, they don't use the NPK formula. They use an NPKS. And they actually tell you how much sulfur is in there. So at this point, sulfur is rarely deficient. But going forwards, we may actually see more deficiencies in soil. Right? But it really doesn't matter what the nutrient is. We also have calcium and magnesium are really important for plants. But again, a lot of soil has a lot of magnesium and calcium, so we don't worry about it. And then all the other things are micronutrients. And in most soil, those aren't a problem either. Our plants seem to find enough of those. They need very little of these other compounds, and they can usually find them in the soil. So we don't have to worry about it. But where we do have to worry about it is in containers where we're using a soilless mix, right? Now all these micronutrients are critical. We have to add those back in, right? And so when we look at fertilizer for potted plants, it's usually a soluble fertilizer, and many of them will have micronutrients mixed in with them. And that's certainly what I would recommend people use. You have to give them the iron and the manganese and the sulfur and all the other nutrients in there.
How long does that last?
If you don't water the container, it will last until the plants use it, with one exception. So all the nutrients will stay in the pot. They don't really go anywhere. Now, when we water a lot, like in the middle of summer when it's really hot, and we water every day, then that water washes them out. So that's the problem. But if we're not watering them, they will just stay there until the plants use them. Nitrogen is the one exception. And that's why nitrogen is almost always on the low side. Nitrogen can leave the soil on its own as nitrogen gas. But what happens more often is that the microbes that are living in there take that nitrate and convert it into nitrogen gas. And that happens in our soil as well. So the microbes in the garden soil are constantly taking some of that nitrogen, converting it into a gas, and then it escapes to the air. So we're losing nitrogen that way, and nitrogen is also very soluble, so it washes out very quickly. In a pot, it washes out the bottom, and in a garden, it just washes down into a low soil profile so the plants can't get it anymore. And those two things, the conversion to nitrogen gas and the washing away of nitrogen, means that nitrogen is always on the low side. And of course, the other reason is that everything in soil wants nitrogen. So the microbes, the plants, the little insects in there, everyone's after nitrogen because that's what they need most for growing. That's what's limiting their growth. So everyone's after nitrogen.
All right. When it comes to vegetable gardening, I've only dabbled in it so far. I'm going to do it a little more seriously this year. I've never fertilized a plant in my life.
Okay.
I was growing tomatoes and they would just take what was in the soil. I'm going to have to fertilize them this year?
So here's the problem you have. And you just described a problem that many people have. You have a garden things sort of grow, right? You're getting tomatoes out of it. You're growing some carrots. And then you get online and someone says, oh, you got to fertilize all this stuff. And you go, okay, so now I have to fertilize. What do I use? If you listen to other people, they're going to tell you what ratio of NPK to put on your soil. But I'm telling you, you have to put on what's missing. So now the question becomes, well, what is missing in my soil? See, it turns out nobody in the world is going to be able to tell you what to put into your garden because I don't know what's missing in your garden. But online, you're going to get all kinds of advice. And it's basically all wrong because no one knows what's missing in your particular soil, right? So how do you find out what's missing in that soil? You have a couple options. You can do what a lot of gardeners do is they just spread some fertilizer and hope they get it right, okay? Which works, is a real waste of resources. And we're starting to run out of phosphate, for instance. It's an expense, but it works because you're getting some nutrients in there. The other option, and a lot of people will tell you this, will get your soil tested. And there's lots of places you can get that tested. And in the U.S., most extension offices will do it. In Canada, some of the universities will do it. There's some private labs. The University of Guelph will certainly test your soil. And what they do is they analyze how many nutrients are in that soil. And then they'll tell you, look, you're high in phosphate, you're low in potassium. You need to add a little bit of this, a little bit of that to bring it up to a level that will grow plants successfully. So that sounds like a great thing to do. Everyone should get their soil tested. Now, before I go on with that, the soil test kits that are sold in most nurseries for gardeners aren't very reliable and are pretty much useless. Okay.
Like that.
They're cheap. So when you don't pay much for a soil test, you get cheap.
I see.
But the real problem is they don't give you numbers. They give you ranges. So you'll do a test and they'll say, oh, your potassium is low. Okay. How low? You don't know. All you know is it's low. Whereas if you send your sample to a real lab, they're going to measure it and they're going to say, here's the number of potassium we got, and here's the number you want to grow tomatoes. And so you have to add this much, and you'll know exactly what to do. You know exactly how much fertilizer to add. Whereas when you do the test yourself, first of all, very inaccurate. Sometimes they're completely wrong. But the real problem is that you don't have a number. So you know it's low and you go, okay, I'm going to throw some out there and hope it's enough. You still haven't solved the problem.
At-home soil test kits. I've read a bit about these online and most people have the same feelings as Robert. They're difficult to use, or at least they're a real pain, and the results are often inaccurate. So why bother? An article from the New York Times comparing DIY kits did note that one in particular, the Mosser Lee Soil Master Soil Test Kit, had an easy-to-read nitrogen kit and an easy-to-read pH kit, although the other kits were a little more problematic. So I looked up how to buy it online, and it turns out they're out of stock.
Now, commercial labs, though, have a problem too, because they don't measure nitrogen, right? Which sounds really weird because nitrogen is the one nutrient we need to know. It's the one nutrient that is probably going to be low, but labs don't test for it. Now, the reason they don't test for it is because by the time you get the sample to the lab and they analyze it and send you a result, the nitrogen has changed. It changes very quickly. So there's no point in measuring it. Okay, if I give you a number for last week, you're going to go, okay, so what? What is it today? So they don't measure nitrogen. And that's one of the reasons I don't generally recommend a soil test. Because nitrogen is the thing you need to know, and it's the thing you won't get an answer for. So you're still stuck. So for most gardeners, I take a different approach. What I would recommend is you grow stuff. Okay. If they grow well, you don't need to fertilize. Okay. If you grow some tomatoes and you get really puny harvest and you're not happy with the harvest, then get a soil test done because something is missing in your soil. At the same time, put some organic matter in there. Get some compost. Put some compost in, and every year put an inch or two of compost. That will pretty much ensure that all the micronutrients are there. It will add some of the other macronutrients, and you're slowly building up the levels in your soil with the organic matter. And you don't need a soil test.
Right.
At the same time, that organic matter is going to help develop a better soil structure, which is also important, right? So it aggregates together and we end up with a better soil quality. So a little bit of organic matter every year, and most gardeners will be just fine. You don't have to add anything else, and you don't have to go and get a soil test done. But if things don't grow properly, then get a soil test done, because it's the only way you will know what's missing from your soil. And it's the only way you'll know what to add to your soil.
Okay. Oh, when choosing something to add to my soil based on these numbers, can you just add pure potassium?
Yes, but it tends to be a little more difficult. You have to find it. If you go to a garden center, like a Home Depot, Canadian Tire type place, they probably won't sell those things. But if you go to a feed store or farm store, you'll be able to buy just the nutrients you want. Now, the other thing you can do is you can buy an NPK that's closer to what you want. So for instance, most soil in North America does not need more phosphate, okay, unless it's really sandy soil. But if you have a bit of clay in there, it's average soil, things have been growing there for a few years, you do not have a phosphate deficiency. So go to a store and find a fertilizer with a zero middle number, because you don't need it and you don't really want it. If you need potassium, try to find one where the middle number is low, the third number, which is potassium, is high, and the nitrogen can be in the middle range, because you can always use a bit of extra nitrogen, right? So you can get close to it, but you can buy just the nutrients you want. And that, in fact, is another reason I don't recommend soil tests, because if you go and get a soil test and they say you need so much potassium and you need so much calcium, then you go to the store and you give them the sheet and say, okay, I need this and this. And they go, okay, we don't sell that, right? I can't give you a fertilizer with just potassium and calcium. And I can't give you a fertilizer with those two things in the right ratio. So then what do? Well, you look around and you say, okay, just give me a bag of 10, 10, 10, and I'll just spread that around. So if you're going to do that, don't get a soil test, because you just wasted your money. Spread the 10, 10, 10. If you're going to spend the money on a soil test, you better follow the directions. Otherwise, you're wasting the soil test and your money. But it is more complicated. And it's almost impossible if you want to go organic, right? So if you want to add potassium and you want to go organic, compost, manure, fish heads, kelp, all these things have everything in it. You're not going to find something with just potassium. Now, if you want just potassium, you could use ashes, which have very high potassium, but they're also alkaline. So that's fine if you have an acidic soil, but you don't want to put it on soil that's already alkaline. Here in Ontario, our soil is about a 7.4, so it's alkaline. We don't want to put ashes in our soil. If you just want nitrogen, then you can get blood meal. So blood meal has a fairly high nitrogen. I have to guess at this, but I'm going to guess it's something like a 1200, and it's released fairly quickly. So if you only need nitrogen, you can use blood meal, but it's pretty expensive, right? But if you want just one of the other nutrients, it's hard to find, especially in organic.
Have you ever wondered what blood meal is? It's dried and powdered blood, mostly cow or pig, mostly from abattoirs. This doesn't turn my stomach, but I'm not vegan. The N value of blood meal is, as Robert said, between 10 and 13%, with the values of P and K at either zero or at a small amount. If you're looking for vegan fertilizer with high nitrogen, consider alfalfa meal. It has an NPK of around 3:1:2. So you're not going to end up with too much of a nutrient in general. You're not going to end up with too much nitrogen in your garden. The problem there is the rivers and streams.
No, you can end up with too much of almost any of the nutrients. So if we take nitrogen first, if you remember back when we used to fertilize our lawns, if you put too much fertilizer on there, the grass died.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's because you put too much nitrogen on there. interestingly, it isn't the high nitrogen that killed the plant. It's actually the fact that the salts in the soil became so high, it sucked the water out of the plant. But that's a bit too scientific. So high nitrogen can certainly kill plants. It's also the reason why we don't use fresh manure, especially chicken manure, because it has a very high nitrogen level. And if you put fresh chicken manure in your garden, you'll kill the plants. And it's that nitrogen that's doing it. You can have too much phosphate. Okay? So all kinds of things happen in the garden that you don't want to happen when it's high phosphate. High phosphate is actually toxic to plants. High phosphate kills off the fungi in the soil, which is not good, right? High potassium is not quite so dangerous. If you get your ratios of calcium and magnesium out of whack, that can cause problems. Plants like them at a certain ratio, and if you get one really high and the other one really low, that causes problems. The other thing that happens with a lot of these is that you'll get like high phosphate also takes away some of the nitrogen. So it robs the nitrogen away from your plants. So you can't have too much of these. And we're seeing more and more, particularly raised beds, where people are putting on lots of organic matter and lots of compost and manure and so on. And then their phosphate levels are so high, they can't grow plants in there. They have what looks like great soil. It's fluffy, it's loose, it's great, black. And it's toxic because they have too much phosphate in there.
Okay. What do you do in that case?
Then you have a real problem. You basically have to keep growing plants and harvesting them and taking them away to remove the phosphate until the level drops down. Or you, if it was a raised bed, that you just throw it away and go get new soil and start over again. That's actually the faster solution. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can definitely have too much. In fact, you can use too much compost. Again, for the same reason, if the compost is rich compost and you put it in, you can have such high levels of, again, usually phosphate, that it becomes toxic. So you have to watch how much of that you use. Mushroom compost is another one. Mushroom compost is made to be really rich for growing mushrooms. And then they usually sell it or give it away afterwards. And it's great compost. And an inch or two on your soil is great. You put 6 inches in and dig it in, and you might not be able to grow any plants because it's too rich, right? It's poisoning the plants.
You can always have too much of a good thing. Too much sun gives you sunburn. If you drink too much water, you get water poisoning, which can kill you. Too much sleep is linked with heart disease, diabetes, and depression. It's the same with plants. Ultimately, enough is enough. Those are words to live by. In looking through some of your writing for this, I was thinking about my own garden that I'm about to start, and it'll be over where there's lawn. So I was planning on using what they used to call the lasagna method, putting down some newspaper, wetting it, and then piling a bunch of topsoil on top. But you said, don't buy topsoil. What should I do?
I don't necessarily say don't buy topsoil. First of all, the lasagna gardening, or what I like to call sheet mulching, is where you put down some newspaper or cardboard, and that kills the grass. You put something on top. There are some people, particularly the garden professors, who are adamant about the fact that, that will destroy your soil and kill all the microbes and everything in the soil.
Oh, really?
And what I find very funny is that one of the garden professors actually has her name on a research paper that shows that doesn't actually happen. But they still tell people that. So lasagna gardening is great. If you're going to do it, use newspaper, not cardboard. Cardboard mm-hmm. takes a long time to decompose. So newspaper will be faster. So, okay, we want to put something on top mostly to hold it in place. That's what it's really doing. So the next question is, what do you want when your lawn is dead and you're ready to garden? If you want to raise the level, then I would use topsoil, because that soil will raise the area of that garden. If you don't want to raise the level, then I would recommend something like compost or manure, because you already have enough soil. What you need to do is make it better, make it richer. And so incorporating some organic matter into that soil will do that. Adding topsoil to soil doesn't help a lot to make it richer. So it's really, what is your goal? Are you going to raise up this area a little bit? Then I would get topsoil. But if you simply want to improve the soil you already have, then something organic.
I was thinking of raising it about 6 inches because I don't want to wait after I built the garden to plant. I'm getting older. I don't want to wait to put in my garden this because it would take what? It would take the full season for the newspaper to break
down. Then you don't need
down.
Any newspaper. Just if you put 6 inches of topsoil onto your lawn, you'll kill the lawn. So skip the newspaper and just cover it with topsoil. Raise it up 6 inches. And you can either put boards around it if you like a raised bed look, or don't. We have this crazy movement of people going to raised beds. And I'm not against raised beds per se. In fact, I started making raised beds 50 years ago. But my raised beds didn't have a lot of wood around them. They were just hilled up soil a little bit. What I have a problem with is people making raised beds that are 3 feet tall. And then they come along and say, well, geez, I just priced the cost of soil and it's so high, I can't fill my beds. And there's no reason to have 3 feet of soil. I know some people have disabilities and that's different. Then you have a reason why you need those high beds and they work well. But most of the people doing that, they just don't want to bend over in the garden. So I actually sat down and I calculated out how much time do you actually bend over in a vegetable garden? And it's such a little amount of time that making those raised beds isn't worth it.
It doesn't feel like a little bit of time when you're kneeling though.
And why are you kneeling?
Because it's so low.
No, but what are you doing while you're kneeling?
I don't know, weeding or something.
I see if you're weeding a vegetable garden, you're not growing your vegetable garden correctly. Vegetable gardens require almost no weeding. So if you mulch properly, you'll have almost no weeds in your garden.
I see.
I grow mine. I have a good 6 inches of straw everywhere. Mm-hmm. I have virtually no weeds. So all I'm doing is, and I don't dig up my garden, which is another thing we're moving away from. So don't till the garden. Don't dig it up. You basically go out in spring and I move the straw away and I plant my tomato plant. I move the straw back and I'm done for the year.
Well, we're about to get deep into another topic, which I would love to do, but I'm mindful of the time and hoping to have Robert back in the future. So I asked him if there was anything else he wanted to discuss. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about with regard to feeding the soil?
Not feeding the soil.
Fertilizing your soil.
Replacing the nutrients. Some of your listeners might be thinking these terms sound like the same thing. And I think if people spend the time and actually think about them, they will make a lot of sense to them. It will save them money in the long run because they're going to use a lot less fertilizer. And that's always good for the environment, right? Less fertilizer of any kind, even organic. So there's people out there who think, if I use manure and compost, I can't use too much. You can, and the excess nitrogen goes into our rivers and streams, right? It doesn't matter whether it's organic or synthetic. If we overuse it in our gardens, we are harming the environment and we're wasting the material. Less is always better. And when you're online and you're going to tell your friends these stories, nobody's going to believe you because 99.9% of the material online will tell you to feed plants and soil is living and you got to feed your soil and so on.
That is what Robert Pavlis had to say to me about replacing nutrients in your garden. It's clarified a lot for me about using compost and fertilizers, and I want to thank Robert. I also want to invite you to contact me. You can through my Instagram account, Flora Fauna CLG Podcast, or through my Facebook page, Flora and Fauna CLG Podcast, or you can email me in the old-fashioned way at Shauna, that's Shauna with a U, at PegasusPublications.net. I'd love to hear from you. It's time to thank the people who help get Flora and Fauna out each week, and they are Yasmin Conception, our producer, Carl Thompson, our graphic designer, Ian Leet, our president, and the Government of Canada, who provided the funding to make Flora and Fauna possible.